My name is Rosalind. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 22nd, 2000. My home group is the Thursday night women's group and the Sunday morning Raritan group. Both meet in Sterling, Virginia. That is in Area 21. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other women, and I go to meetings on a regular basis. These are the things that keeps me sober a day at a time. I remember my first and last drink like it was yesterday. I remember what I was thinking. I remember the feelings. I remember who I was with, my emotions. I remember everything about those days. That first drink, I was 17 years old, and I remember drinking to fit in. I wanted to be a part of. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to change how I was feeling. And alcohol did that for me for a while. I had fun with it. I danced, partied, socialized. I remember going to work, my coworkers on Thursdays when we got paid. We'd go out to the club and happy hour and go home, get up, go to work the next morning. And I had fun with alcohol. But the disease of alcoholism is progressive. And I started this downward spiral that I could not stop. I could not put the brakes on. I didn't know what was going on because I was not familiar with alcoholism. I didn't see it growing up in my household. And I was also taught that I could do whatever I put my mind to doing, but for the life of me, I could not stop drinking. Countless efforts. I tried everything. Nothing worked. And at the end, the feelings were that of despair, loneliness, isolation, shame, embarrassment. I remember being in my bedroom with the door locked and a chair propped up underneath it, totally shutting the world out. This is where alcohol had taken me. And still, I could not stop. I just couldn't stop. And I just kept on, one just right after the next, until I started feeling like I was having a massive heart attack. I got so scared because I thought I was dying. I really felt like I was dying, and I put everything to the side, and I prayed a prayer that I had never prayed, and so sincere. God, please don't let me die like this. Don't let my children find me in my room. Don't let me die. Don't let me die. Don't let me die. And I went off to sleep, and I woke up the next morning. I go, and I resumed the activity that I had started the night before, truly believing that I was going to die. This was my first real understanding of powerlessness. I had no defense against that first one. My best efforts was just doing what I was doing, killing myself with my own hands with alcohol and drugs. So what happened? After I finished everything, I said another sincere prayer. I said, God, please help me. Help me. I don't know what to do. I don't want to die like this. And I had been introduced to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had my foot in the door. I was in and out. I didn't think that it was work. I didn't really hear nothing. I was too busy poking holes and just looking at the books and wondering why the commas was in the wrong places and, you know. And every time I would leave out and I'd pray, he'd send me back there again. Nowhere different, you know. But this last time I've said that prayer, my phone rang. And it was one of the ladies that I had met in the meetings. And she called me and she said, Rosalind, when you join our family and we don't see you anymore, we worry about you. We miss you. How are you doing? I said, I'm not doing good. And she said, would you like to go to a meeting? And I said, yes. And at this point, I was as willing as the dying could be to save my life, to get a new way of life, to just change how I was feeling, that dark, that gloom, that loneliness, that emptiness. I just wanted to change, just feeling of just wanting to die every day, just not wanting to live, not living life, just existing. She came and got me, and she took me to an AA meeting. She brought me home, And she said, are you going to be okay? And I said, no, I'm not. I mean, I don't know what it's going to take for me, but I really didn't feel much different than I felt the night before. And she said, no problem. Can I use your phone? And see, this is how the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked, which is why I have to give it back, because it was so freely given to me, no strings attached. She called her husband, and she said, I won't be home tonight. See, another suffering alcoholic needed help, and she stayed there to help me. I didn't feel worthy of her help. And she literally held my hand until I got the help that I needed. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous through treatment as well. I remember I had like 7 sponsors in 1 year because they all did stuff wrong, you know. And one of the sponsors, I remember her telling me, see, things come back to me as I move along. And I remember her saying, service work keeps you sober, Rosalind. You need to get in service. And she said, when I was new, I cleaned the bathrooms. And I remember saying to myself, oh, my God, I would never clean nobody's bathrooms. Yeah, that wasn't service to me. And when I went into treatment, my first chore was cleaning the bathrooms. But I tell you, those are the lengths that I went through to get sober today. I was so ashamed and so, you know, embarrassed of where alcohol had taken me. I had to learn things like humbling myself and acceptance and surrendering. Those words used to be weak, and the pride and all of that used to be strong. And I learned, I had to change everything about myself, you know, but I was so willing. I didn't realize how sick I was until I started getting better. I didn't know that, you know, pride was keeping me sick, embarrassment, you know, going to work with this image like everything was okay, and being around my family and trying to clean up the best that I can, and on the inside I'm dying, you know. I was tired of living like that. I was tired of living that way. And then the more meetings I started going to, what I found out, 3 things in particular stood out to me. First and foremost, you all had a solution to my problem. This is the only thing that worked for me. Nothing else I tried worked, nothing. 2, I remember my first home group of Alcoholics Anonymous was the Cosmopolitan Group in Washington, D.C., and this was the meeting that Jim had started, Jim's story in the big book. And this group recently celebrated their 80th anniversary. But what stood out so much, not so much that he started that group, but back in 1935, when the country was practicing segregation, Alcoholics Anonymous was helping each other stay sober, black and white. You know, Jim's sponsor, Charlie, was white, and they would come and help them, and they would help the group get started, and when they couldn't afford to pay their rent, they helped them. Nobody else was doing that. That was impressive to me. It just kind of stood out. And third and most important is we have something called step work. Yeah. One of the treatment centers that I went to several of those, you know. But one of them, I remember the counselor saying, if everybody were to practice the steps, this would be a better world. And that had attracted me to wanting to do step work. And man, just being able to clean house and, you know, I mean, the order that they come in, you know, it's spiritual. It's just spiritual in nature. Acceptance, admitting, and, you know, but as far as this topic goes, because the second step says that it came to believe. Before I came to believe, I had to be willing to believe. Because even though I was raised in the church, I mean, we went to church every Sunday. I was very active in the church. I found God in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was there where I saw people getting sober, people getting up sharing gut-level honest bottoms, you know, where they hit. And then in the next sentence saying, I'm celebrating 5 years. Like, wow. It's like hope, you know, like, man, if this works for you, I know it can work for me. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that's happened to me. I wouldn't trade this for anything in the world. And in closing, I just want to I want to share, and no, before I close, I can't say that without saying, since I've been here, I want to say, I lost my dad. See, I didn't think I can get through things, and that's the other thing that I really wanted, was being able to deal with life situations, life challenges, sober. You know, drinking to oblivion, not being able to help anybody, you know. I lost my dad. I lost my brother. I lost a job. I got divorced. I broke my ankle. you know, that was traumatic because they put me on pain meds, and for a minute I got excited, and that next minute, and right after that, I got scared. I called my sponsor in a hurry, you know, and I still need to take, but it was the women in that Thursday night meeting and that Sunday morning meeting that text me and that called me and that was just there for me when my dad passed, when I moved to New Hampshire, you know, and they were there for me when I moved there. They were there for me when I moved back. And when I moved there, my first thought was, wow, don't nobody know me here, you know. But then I go to a meeting, and then the young lady asked me to sponsor her, and she kept me sober, you know. And that's how this program works, you know. Just I'm fortunate to have sponsees that do the work, call me every day, you know. Like, you know, when I don't want to talk, they call me, you know. But it keeps me sober a day at a time. And I'm so thankful to you women and the men of the Sunday group, the Thursday night meeting. I cannot, and that's what I learned, is I can't do this thing by myself. No matter how much I try, I still try it. I'll still try it. And then I'll get faced with, oh gosh, I got to reach out and need help, you know. But I have to remember that I can't do this by myself. But in closing, I want to share a movie that I watched back in 1990. It was before I got sober, but that movie just touched my heart back then, before I hit my bottom. But it's called Simon Birch. And some of you may have seen it. But Simon was, and the caption, if you read the caption, it'll say he was a misfit because he was born very small. He was much smaller than his peers, you know. But he didn't concentrate on that. What he kept, he knew that God had made him that way for a reason. And throughout the story, Simon would walk around and he'd ask the pastor and his teacher and his best friend, what is God, do you know what God's plan is for me? He knew God had a plan for him. They said, no, Simon, we don't know, you know. But he never stopped asking. He knew God had a special plan for his life. They called him a misfit. That's what they called him. And at the end, you know, I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but I'm not going to tell the total ending. But near the end, they were coming from a class trip, and a school bus went over into the water. And as the water starts submerging, filling up the bus, kids start panicking, screaming. And they couldn't open that door from the inside. Simon was the only one small enough to get through the window. And he was able to open the door from the outside, and the kids were able to get out. And it was a tearjerker, but it's just some reason that movie stuck with me. And now I see today, I'm like Simon. You know, I always felt like I didn't fit in, so I guess that makes me a misfit, huh? You know? But I know today, I've wondered too, what is God's will for me? Today I have no doubt that his will for me is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. And how I explained how it was given to me and how they helped me, still, that I have to give it back. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that's ever happened to me, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. Thank you.
Nice, Rosalind. Thank you. Next up is Scott from Massachusetts.
Hi, everybody. My name is Scott. I'm an alcoholic. It always brings back that I'm going to be okay feeling, you know. It's going to be okay. Alcohol is so powerful, you don't even have to drink it to feel better, right? Just get that bottle in your hand. Ooh, it's going to be okay. How exciting. I've been sober since the 3rd of May in 1987. Very grateful. I give all the credit of that to my my higher power that Alcoholics Anonymous offered me, my sponsor. I've had a sponsor since day one. And a family. My family cared more about me than I cared about myself and forced me into taking a look at my alcoholism. And I stand here today, 28 years sober, because of those facts. A few key individual people in my early recovery took me under the wing, showed me the ropes, and taught me how to be a gentleman, you know. Now, I struggle with that today. I'm not, like, you know, perfect, but I was certainly given some good exposure, some tutelage in my early recovery. Our topic, you know, willing to believe. Rosalind did a great job. You know, she took her first drink when I took my last drink. It's interestingly to say. I've been sober in AA since I was a teenager. I feel very lucky for this fact. I feel like I was plucked out of the talons of active alcoholism and set down in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the AA army, our brothers and sisters, just swarmed and carried me out of that self-loathsome, angry, miserable place that I've found myself in, and I blamed all of you for it, you know? It was your fault, you know what I mean? You know, we all have a list. My mother died when I was 12. My brother beat me like a drum. I'm the youngest. I was beat like a drum. I was ridden like a bicycle. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I'm the shortest one in my family. My sister's taller than me. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, our list, you know. And if you had that, you would drink too, you know. I'll be all right if you leave me alone kind of thinking, you know. That was a very real thing. And what's interesting as I look across the crowd and see all the nodding heads is that I'm not alone with that. I really felt like I was the only one, you know. But the reality is I had more faith in alcohol. My story, I should qualify that I did drugs alcoholically. The alcoholic condiments, you know, the powders and pills and things like that. You know. It's true. And I did drugs alcoholically, and I don't know. I've found a home in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had more faith in alcohol than I did in anything else. I didn't believe my family. I didn't believe teachers. I certainly didn't believe the police. You know what I mean? I believed my friends. My drug dealer was like my hero. You know what I mean? But, you know, there's a line in the book that's talked about a self-imposed crisis, you know. That's what my reality was. I kept drinking and using other chemicals, and I brought myself into a very dark place. And because of my family who cared more about me than I did about myself, I found myself in this treatment center in Cleveland, Ohio, from Rochester, New York. And instantly, I realized that there was an architectural flaw in the building. There were no doorknobs on my side of the door. And I thought, come on, seriously? It's not that bad, you know? But getting there was a process, and recovery is a process. And for me, this willing to believe, like Rosalind stated, it, you know, it was a process. Came to believe. The word came. It's a process. You know, as individuals, we come through that process. I grew up with zero religious training. In my mind's eye, I think I viewed gods like ghosts. You know, probably are, but irrelevant to me. You know, I was in the woods. I was fishing, hiking, growing up in that sort of fashion. And so when Alcoholics Anonymous said that it really doesn't matter what God is, as long as you know that you ain't it, I went to nature. And in nature, I found a way to open the door to believing in something other than alcohol and drugs. And No, I'll tell you a little story for identification. It's a long story, but I'm going to condense it down to the highlight. Johnny Carson was on the tube, and I can tell you that with a lot of the faces in here know who Johnny Carson was. Sometimes I say this in young people's meetings, and they're like, "Didn't you mean Jimmy Kimmel?" You know? I had a black and white television. Oh, black and white? You mean the outside colors? Johnny Carson was on the tube, and at this point, I was under a lot of pressure through programs my family had put me in to stop it, cut it out, and, you know, I still had that thinking of, I'll be fine if you leave me alone. But Johnny Carson was on the tube, and I had been told by a very trustworthy source who dealt that if I were to drink vinegar, that I would be able to beat the urinalysis test. Seemed maybe a little extreme, but reasonable. I mean, I was desperate. You know, I gotta beat this test. I mean, the idea of actually not drinking was completely out of the question. I gotta beat the test. You know what I'm saying? I mean, this is back in the time in the mid '80s when like the Beastie Boys came up with that tune. You gotta fight for your right to party, and man, you gotta fight for your right to party. That's my war cry, man. And so, drinking vinegar. Oh, all right, you know, I'll never forget it. Carson was on the tube saying something silly, and I had about 8 shots of vinegar in a clear glass. I put it up. It smelled heinous. I drank it down in 1 shot, and I could do this with vodka, so I could do it with vinegar, right? I clutched my throat as tears streamed down my face, and my insides did jumping jacks, and oh my God, I went to bed, and I had horrible dreams. I just like got up in the morning, and I'll spare you some of the detail of what came out of me in the morning, but I walked into that urinalysis test, and I'm like, give me the cup! I had more faith in alcohol and drugs than I did in Alcoholics Anonymous or higher power or in a life that would be without those things. Well, I failed the test. Thank God for that, right? Thank God for that. I feel so lucky. Off I went into that place with no doorknobs, and I couldn't believe that I was there. I'm like, hang on a second. I drank vinegar. This is supposed to work, you know? Oh, by the way, some drug addicts were telling me that I drank the wrong vinegar. Just my luck, you know? Always a dollar late, short and a day late, you know? And thank God for that. Thank God for that. I had all the normal excuses. I can't be. I'm too young. I was a teenager. Man, I'm too young. And, you know, the education process that I received in treatment and since in Alcoholics Anonymous with good sponsorship has shown me that, well, to put it simply, you know, it doesn't matter how much I drank. It doesn't matter how often I drank. It doesn't matter where I drank. And I drank in some seedy places. What matters is what happens when I do drink. And because of all the circumstantial evidence, I was sent away, and I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been a member of a home group. My home group is the Saturday Night Keep It Simple group at the How It Works Clubhouse in Bellingham, Massachusetts. And I feel so grateful for that. You know, my wife is speaking this afternoon, and we're talking like, oh, are you prepared? And I'm like, I haven't drank for 28 years. I'm involved in sponsorship. I sponsor people. I'm prepared. You know what I mean? I read the book with newcomers. I don't know. This is, you know, it's an opportunity to share my experience at an AA meeting. You know, our venue here is enormous. How about this convention, right? Wow. Woo-hoo! Love it. You know, we know something about independence as recovering alcoholics, don't we? You know, yeah, I'm grateful to be American, living in the greatest country on the face of the planet. You know, I know about independence, but when you say that I'm a recovering alcoholic, man, I tell you what, there's a whole different connotation to that, and I am so grateful. I am not that guy that was sitting under in the wicked rainstorms, sitting underneath the bank awning, trying to get high, drink. I'm so grateful. Now, the concept of willing to believe in something other than alcohol and drugs, it plays in my life now. Sober for years, right? I still, because of my personality and my ego, my whatever righteousness, I'll put it to a term. I'm so self-centered that I need a higher power. I pray to God. I'm so self-centered. I am praying to God daily to help me with my self-centeredness. I'll call my sponsor about it. You know, fill in the blank. Boss is a jerk. The client stinks. You know what I mean? My gorgeous wife. She only has 18 years of sobriety. But she points out that it's quality, not quantity. Right? Right? Shout out to you, KB. That I struggle, you know. A dear friend of mine said once at SVI that just because you're sober, it doesn't give us a bulletproof shield to life, right? So being willing to believe is my higher power going to work in my financial circumstances? Is my higher power going to work in this situation with work? Is my higher power, am I going to be, you know what I mean? Because I struggle with the illusion that I'll be better when I need more money. I need to have more sex. I need to have a better job. I need a different car. I need to live in a different zip code. You know what I'm saying? Like, fill in the blank. These kinds of things. This, I'll be better when. And my sponsor is very... I love you, Kevin. He is so willing to repeat himself. Oh, my God. I hear myself saying the same thing with a different term, a different name. Well, it's the boss, you know. She did it again. And it's the same stuff, you know. What it comes down to is ego deflation and depth. We all understand this with alcohol. And then we all go through other... I've gone through other bottoms in that self-will when riot, sober. Do you know what I mean? The bulletproof shield that we just don't get when we're sober. It's life happens. So on a daily basis, I try to put on my sober armor by saying prayers. I like to say the Serenity Prayer. It's comfortable for me, you know. There are other prayers that I don't like as much. But I try to say that Serenity Prayer 10 times in the morning. And it's almost like a meditative experience for me. And as I say, go through that process, my mind, my streams of consciousness wander off to food or, you know, I'm a list maker. So I start making lists. I got this, I got that. Oh, yeah, yeah, the Serenity. And then I come back, God, Grammy. And so I go through that process. And that, for me, that's putting on my sober armor, because without it, I am left defenseless against the slings and the arrows and the barbs that the world can bring, you know. And self-will when riot can really, I don't know. To me, taking a drink is the end of a relapse, you know. Taking a drink is the end of an actual relapse. It is the beginning of a spree, but it is the end of the relapse. So if I don't protect myself spiritually on a daily basis to try to get spiritually fit, the world, my alcoholism in the world's too big. I feel very lucky that when I get home from here, I'm going to have all you with me. You know what I'm saying? To help me deal with the circumstances that I without Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have to be dealing with by myself and drugs. So. And alcohol. Anyway, I'm willing to believe through the process of humiliation, sober. I went through it drunk. That there is relief, and more often than not, what it seems to be coming to me through good sponsorship and higher power is that I need to get out of the way. You know what I mean? I am always seemingly in my way because I'll be better when. You don't understand when you know how you get life in the headlock and you start throwing uppercuts and you're like, this has to happen for me to be okay, you know? That is when I'm at my worst. So I have I talk to my sponsor all the time, and I go to lots of meetings, and I feel like I've been given that reprieve on a daily basis to try to be a better guy. And I don't know. Here I am in the middle of this wonderful conference, having the opportunity to share. I'm so lucky. If any of you folks do not want to end up on this side of the podium, do not get involved in service. Okay, whatever you do, stay away from the delegates. It's just amazing. The Area 30 delegate Michelle P is a personal friend of mine. Went through the traditions with her, and had the opportunity to be here today with you fine folks. So I thank you.
If I'd have been Scott, I would have got a different vinegar sponsor, right? You know? But, Scott, thank you very much for your message. Up next, Susan from California.
Hello, everybody. My name is Susan, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 18 May 1979. My life is truly blessed. I am standing here before you, you know, a woman who could not have existed before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. All right. Oh, I wrote a speech. This introduction, I did that. Sobriety date, I did that. Okay, I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who had a sponsor who had a sponsor, and I sponsor people. Okay, I go to lots of meetings. Okay, I do. I still go to a lot of meetings. Okay, and let's see, it says, say thank you. I want to thank the convention committee. Sitting here in the front row is my sister, Mary Pat. She is a past delegate from Area 56, am I right? She is in panel 52, if anybody wants to know. She is the one who volunteered me for this gig. So you all get the benefit from it. And I'm going, I was sitting up here, and Scott goes, oh, there's June. Do you know June? And I go, that is June. So I know June. I know who June is, okay? But she's untouchable, you know? She is just fabulous in the South Bay of California. It's just wonderful. It's wonderful to share the room with her. And I am just impressed that all of you all are here instead of over in Building A listening to Clancy.
Yes.
Okay. So, all right, let me take my watch off so that I can see the clock every once in a while. Make sure I don't go over, because I will tell you one thing about this microphone. It's an addiction. Sometimes people go, oh, you are so funny. And I'm going, yes, except when I try to be. So I don't ever expect to see me in the nightclubs, you know. I took up pole dancing earlier this year for a while until my knees wouldn't handle it anymore. So, I mean, seriously, we have a younger sister who pole dances for exercise, and her arms are like steel bands under here, you know. She's not going to be 62 looking like this, I'll tell you. But that's okay. I look really good for 62.
Yeah.
And I was talking to the marriage therapist, and I said, I really look good for 62. And she goes, I thought you were 15 years younger. And I go, I look really good for 48. Anyways, so I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1979. I actually came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978. Okay, that was about a year after a 12-hour blackout, where I woke up in a latrine. Okay, I'll tell you that I spent 20 years in the Air Force, so everybody who knows what a latrine is, okay. Those of you who don't, ask somebody who does. And I was wrapped in a blanket. I had on one sock under the blanket. And I'm going, where are the rest of my clothes? Okay? And I know that that is the kind of life that I lived as a drunk. I grew up in a family. My sister yesterday, she spoke yesterday, and she said, alcoholism really runs in our family. And I just always said, it gallops. It gallops. You know what I knew in my family is that I used to hear my uncle say this. The difference between a drunk and an alcoholic is alcoholics have to go to those damn meetings. So welcome to your damn meeting, okay? It always appeared to me that in my family, the men were alcoholics and the women married them. Until my generation. In my generation, the women did it too. You know, I don't think we did much bra burning, but we certainly did a lot of alcohol drinking. Okay. I will tell you, I'd like to share with you some of the things that I didn't do. I joined the Air Force, okay? And in basic training, I kept hearing this all the time. If you stay in for 3 years and you don't get caught, you get a good conduct medal. I got three of those bad boys. You know, what was I going to say about being in the military? And so, you know, I spent 20 years, 23 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes. Okay? I get a pension, you know, that will never get smaller. It won't ever get much bigger. It won't ever be enough to really live on. But, you know, it's paid the rent. Whoa, what is this? Am I too close to the microphone, aren't I? I told you, you know, it's a certain love affair. So you have to be gentle with it, though. So I joined the Air Force to get away from home. You know, there was just too much drinking, too much violence, too much of everything. You know, when you grow up in an alcoholic home, you don't know that people live happy, joyous, and free lives. You just don't know that, you know. When you grow up in an alcoholic home where there's a lot of violence and a lot of sexual violence on young children, you don't know that there is another way to live. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I brought my certain beliefs with me. You're pretty ugly and you're pretty apt to stay that way. You don't need a high school education to get married and have kids. Women are good for one thing. Okay? And actually, I was okay with that because apparently men only want one thing. You know? And I liked it. So, you know, then when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous to quit drinking. I wanted to control my behavior when I drank. I wanted a different life, but I didn't really want to give up my alcohol. So about a year after that 12-hour blackout, and you know, things happen. I mean, I just know that I went to bed with men that I would not have gone to lunch with if I'd been sober. And I wanted to change my behavior. And so I told my girlfriend, you know, I was on the night shift. She was on the night shift. I worked the swing. She worked the midnight. She was in the motor pool. I was in the computer room. And she said, we had spent the whole weekend. I had spent the whole Labor Day weekend, 1978. Just in an alcoholic haze. There were no sharp corners in my world. And it's a good thing because I was bumping into them a lot. But I said, Trudy, I said, I think I've got a drinking problem. And she goes, oh, no, not you, Susie. You know, she and I, we could drink. We could put it away. And she goes, oh, no, not you, Susie. I always made sure that when we were out drinking together in my car that she got out of my car before she started puking. You know, because did I tell you all that I got sober at Misawa Air Base in Japan? Now, that's a long way from Kentucky. I just want to say that, okay? So she said, well, if you're serious, we better call Jay. And I'm going, whoever Jay is. So she calls up this guy named Jay, and he comes running over. This is Tuesday morning after Labor Day weekend, right? And so, and she's cleaning vomit off of, out of her room. But I just said, I think I've got a drinking problem. And she goes, oh, no, not you. And she probably didn't have a drinking problem either. She just had a vomiting problem, you know? And so, anyways, when Jay comes over pedaling on his bicycle, and he lays out all these pamphlets for me on a table, and I'm just going, okay. And he says, if you're serious, now this is Tuesday morning, if you're serious, don't drink and come to the meeting Saturday night. We had one group. It met three times a week. I was on swing shift, so I got to go on Saturday night. So I show up to the meeting on Saturday night without a drink. Surprise! And he goes, wow, I wasn't expecting this. And I said, it's okay. So I kept going. 30 days later on a Friday night, I get off work a little early, and I go, I'm feeling pretty good. I think I'll go downtown and have a drink. So I did. I went downtown and I had a drink. I went home and I went to bed, and I woke up Saturday morning and said, I'm not an alcoholic. I can have one and go home. And then I went and got drunk. So then I went and talked to Jay. And he said, I said, Tree said you wouldn't talk to me because I'm drunk. And he goes, she's right. The next time I won't. So I said, okay. So I went to the meeting drunk. And then I didn't. I went go to the meetings 30 days. Friday night, I'd get off work, go downtown, have one drink. Saturday, I'd get drunk. And I did that over and over and over again. So you see, I could not stop drinking. Even just going to meetings. And I will tell you, it was me and the sailors, you know. It was just a bunch of men in the meeting and me. And they let me sit in the meeting under the influence, you know. I didn't disturb anybody. I didn't make noise. I didn't, you know, I wasn't funny. But they weren't laughing. And then one Saturday night, about 8 months later, I showed up. I'd been 2 weeks away from my last drink. There was a woman at the meeting, sober 2.5 years. And I'm going, my first reaction is, and I was really rough back then, but it was like, who does she think she is coming to my meeting? That's not what I really thought. But, I've kind of grown away from that language. I thought to myself, it works for women. It works for women. Now, I will tell you that when my dad died, he was 24 years sober, okay? If he had not been in this program, I might not have come. Okay, I will say that. Probably the best thing that he ever did for our family was go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it opened the door. And I was in Japan when I got sober. But I was in so much pain. I was in so much pain because I came here with this belief system that I'm not worth anything except one thing. I was pretty ugly and pretty apt to stay that way. I wasn't smart. You're never going to amount to anything, so don't even try. I'm going to hate to see what your house looks like when you grow up. Well, you know, anybody would hate to see my house now that I'm growing up. I'll tell you that right now. It's not my... I'm not going to say that I'm lazy. I'm just going to say it's not my priority. But I don't like housework. Anyways, when I found out that even if you don't drink, it doesn't mean you're going to change your behavior. But I will say that I no longer went to bars to pick up men. There were plenty of them in AA meetings. Thank you. It's the truth. And you know, I got to tell you, it's like even now, even when I wasn't feeling very pretty, you know, when you're willing to lay down, almost anybody will think you're cute. Anyways, so what happened was, in the military, I remember I got a job working as a drug and alcohol rehab counselor when I was a couple years sober. And that's about the time that I started feeling suicidal. So my message is a lot for the still suffering alcoholic who sits in these rooms dying a slow death. You know, I did not know about PTSD until I had gone through college, got my commission, and went to squadron officer school, and there was a psychologist there talking about PTSD. And I said, wow, those are the very things that I go through. And then he says, and I heard it, these are the exact same things that people who have been raped and suffer sexual abuse go through. And I'm going, all right, there's a name for it, you know. And I will tell you that my problem with step two was not the came to believe part. It was the restored to sanity part. Because I did not want to own up that I might be a little bit mentally off. I would rather be an alcoholic, thank you very much. You know? So, and I grew up, I never went to treatment, you know, and I never got caught. I never, ever got a DUI. I'm not saying I never drove drunk. I never took illicit drugs because I didn't want to break the law. I never took a prescribed medication that was not prescribed for me, and I never took it in a way that was not prescribed for me because I was in the military and I had a clearance. Okay. And there are just certain things you don't do when you have a clearance. But I didn't mind driving under the influence of alcohol. And I bought a brand new car one time, and I'm going, I'm never going to drive this car drunk. And I can't tell you how many times that car got left at the NCO club. Until eventually, you know, I broke it in. But back to the story of willing to believe, you know, willing. I had to be willing. There's that everybody loves Dr. Paul's story about, and acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. And I'm going, acceptance? Why should I accept? My mother was killed in a car wreck when I was 3 and a half. I was sexually molested on a regular basis by 5 different men in my family until I was 14 years old. Why should I accept that? It's their fault. I do not owe anything for anybody for that. You know what I found out? In Alcoholics Anonymous, healing comes through forgiveness, whether it's asked for or not. Whether it's asked for or not, healing comes through forgiveness. One of the things, you know, I love the promises, and I just have to tell you some of the funny stuff that I've learned over the years. I was 9 months sober when I left Japan, and I was an old timer. Okay, my sponsor had 2.5 years, and her husband had 7, but I was next with 9 months. Okay, and I landed in Sacramento, where the average amount of sobriety was 20 years. I went from 3 meetings a week to 500 meetings a week. And I wanted my 20 years right now. When I was 12 years sober was when I realized that it takes 20 years to get 20 years of sobriety. And all I really have is the little time right here between the claps. All I have is this very moment. You know, that's all I have. When I was 20 years sober, I discovered that how you get freedom from the fear of economic insecurity is you have a job and you spend less than you earn. Easy. easy. Okay. I will tell you that over the course of my sobriety, I have spent a lot of time in therapy. God bless every therapist who ever helped me. I always thought that I was going in working on my incest issues, you know. And I am so grateful for the women in and out of the program who have interacted in my life, who have intervened on my behavior, okay, on my behalf, who saved my life. Because even if you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you're still doing high-risk behaviors, you still have a high-risk life. So I have spent a lot of years in therapy. I'm not afraid of going to therapy. I'm not afraid of somebody saying, oh, how did you get out of that without going insane? And because I realized that the logical step would have been to go mind broke. You know, to go there. And we had one sister who did not survive. You know, I was always given the message of, if you tell anybody, I'm going to kill you. And my sister talked and she died. Now, I don't think anybody killed her, okay, but she talked and she died. So it's a powerful lesson to me, you know. And what I realized when I was almost 6 years sober is that if I don't talk, I'm going to die. That if I don't tell somebody how much I'm hurting, I'm going to die. When I got this invitation to speak and I called my sponsor and I said, I just started crying because it is such a humbling experience to be up here. And I will tell you, it's one that I kind of wanted, you know. But I would never have asked for it myself. So, anyways, I got lost. Shoot. Yeah. No, it was before that. Yeah. Okay, we go to therapy, okay. I think that for me, I moved to California. I have been sober. I got sober in Japan, been sober in California, Illinois, Minnesota. I went to Germany to install a computer system. I lived on Guam for 2.5 years. That's where I met my husband, okay. I was at his very first meetings. I was about 10 years sober when he was going to his very first meetings. And I'm just going, ah. That man, every time he opened his mouth, I'm going, ooh, what does he have, you know? And about 8 months later, I'm thinking, nah, he might be worth going out on a date with. And about that same time, I had been, because I'm just going, I was married once before, and I thought, I lost a husband to alcoholism. And saying that you lost a husband is like thinking, oh, you put him on a shelf somewhere, and you forgot where the shelf was, you know. But that's not what happened. I know that we got divorced because I had to drink, and he didn't want me to. And I had to. I didn't really have a choice about whether or not I was going to drink. So, anyways, when my sister got sober, my younger sister got sober next in Kansas. Then I had a sister in Cincinnati. She got sober next. She says that I prayed her in. Okay. I was trying to get a long-distance intervention going, but I was told, you know, you really cannot do that. You have to let it go. And so I started praying because I knew that she would get drunk and sit in her van and sleep it off. And it's really cold in Cincinnati in the wintertime. And I figured someday I'm going to get a call that she died. She froze to death under the influence and sitting in her van sleeping because she didn't want to drive drunk. And so I started praying that when she dies, I'll be able to handle it. And then the most miraculous thing happened. She started getting DUI sentenced to AA, DUI sentenced to AA, DUI sentenced to AA. It's like, you know? And then she gets sober and she ends up being a delegate from Cincinnati on panel 52. And I'm just going, huh, okay. So prayer, I came to believe that prayer works in a way that, you know, so it's like I just, prayer works, you know. We're okay. I got time for a few more stories. It's like, I never know which stories are going to come out of my mouth. I really don't. And that's the reason why I took notes, because when I stand at a microphone, it's about me. And I have to remember to say thank you to you. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for laughing at the nonsense that brings us here. You know, thank you for that. Thank you for understanding. Thank you for sharing in my recovery today. Today, I live a life that is, and you've heard it, I know that you hear it at every meeting. I live a life that is beyond my wildest dreams. There is no violence. There is, in one generation, we went from violence to raising a loving family with children who respect their parents. You know, that I was already sober when I got married and had my kids. I didn't even have to quit smoking because, you know, Bob Earl told me I had to quit smoking a long time ago, so I did. And anyways, when I pray, and I will tell you, my dad died 24 years sober, and he never once tried to make amends to me or any of my sisters. And I was at church. AA gave me back my religion. I was at church one Sunday night, and I'd gone to communion. And after communion, you know, there's a little time you go back and you sit down and you meditate and you say prayers. And I just said, God, help him be willing to ask you for help, to ask you for forgiveness, because he sure is not asking me. And the message that I got straight back was, it's okay. There's nothing you can do about it. It's out of your hands. 30 minutes later, my sister Mary Pat called me. He had died right at that moment. The last words out of his mouth were, you've got to help me. Now, you can believe what you want to about that, and I know that other people in the family believe what they want to about that, but I know what I believe. You know, one of the things that I learned when I went back to my church, because I started teaching religious education, because while we are very, very rich in a lot of things, there wasn't enough money to really pay for religious education for my kids, so I taught. And I learned about a loving God. I learned about a God who loves all of his kids. And it doesn't matter what kind of horse trader, horse thief, drunken, low-down scum you are, God loves you. And God loves me. And I have been able to turn that around for myself. And when I look in the mirror today, and I know that I did not have to do a thing to earn the title of special child of God any more than any of you all do. And that is what doing, you know, being willing to believe. I truly believe that I am a special child of God, and nobody ever gets to take that away from me. Thank you very much.